vice chair, and I believe Representative Barnes and probably Representative Morgan is out of town. So we should the rest of them will probably be coming in here. I'll wait about another 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll kick it off. But I want to thank you for coming up. Who all did you bring with you now?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to introduce some of the staff. I think it's always good when we come before the committee, to, particularly early in the year, to have some of the folks from Fish and Game here.
Please feel free to, if you want to, just pull some chairs right up to the table and put one, two, three, or four. This is your chance to present to us an overview of issues that you think are important that we should have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right, we've got Kevin Delaney, Director of Sport Fish. Many of these folks are familiar to you. David Benton is the Deputy Commissioner working on the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the North Pacific Council. Doug Meekham, Director of Commercial Fisheries. Hi. Elizabeth Andrews is the Assistant Director.
Hi, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm.
Bob Bosworth, the other Deputy Commissioner. Jaron Bruce is the Legislative Liaison in the Commissioner's Office. And Bruce Twomley with the Limited Entry Commission.
See you again, Bruce.
Okay. The whole audience.
Yeah, well, we almost outnumber you.
Yeah.
With that, since we've got a pretty much of a full boat here now, it is now, my co-chairman says, we can start by this watch and end by that watch, and we'll get done a little sooner.
All right.
So my chronometer says about 1:36 or 1:37. This is the House Resources Committee. Today, in attendance for the record, is Representative Kapsner on this end, Representative Whitaker on the two ends of the spectrum.
But friends of the left.
Harris, who tries to keep them all squared away, and Mr. Vice Chair John Cowdery, Representative Jewell, who provides a different perspective altogether. And Madam Co-Chair, Representative Masick. And today we are having a teleconference listen-only meeting to have an overview of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And again, Commissioner Frank Rue is before us, and he has brought along a number of his important people to help us ask questions and perhaps to fill us in on the issues. And we'll go ahead and give you the opportunity to make some opening statements, make your presentation, Commissioner. The chair will leave it up to the committee members. If anybody's got a burning question somewhere in the middle of the process there, I will recognize them and they can ask that question. But I would rather like to see us go ahead and get the full presentation here, and then we can go ahead and ask some questions. I think we presented you with some questions, or I have some as well. So with that, Commissioner Rue, welcome to the committee, and we're here to listen to you, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. As you said, I'm Frank Rue, Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. I did get some of the issues I know you all would like to talk about, and so what I thought I'd do is give you a brief overview of some of the questions I know you have, and then leave some time. Do we have, what, about 45 minutes, an hour?
We have until, we've got a couple of hours here.
Oh, okay.
At least an hour and a half.
Okay. I'll run through some of the issues I know are on your mind, or have others come up and do that, and then leave it open to questions. Again, thank you for having us before the committee. We're always happy to come and meet with either individual members or the committee to discuss particular issues that you might have, and so I look forward to that opportunity over the course of the session here. I've got Deputy Commissioner Benton here. I'd like him to give you an update on the Pacific Salmon Treaty issues, and if there are North Pacific Fisheries Management Council questions you all might have, I'd like perhaps have him come up now. He's got a 2 o'clock meeting he's going to be late for, so perhaps he could spend 15, 20 minutes on those two issues. We'll go through those rather than me summarizing them and then having him come and give you the details. Why don't we just have him present those two issues, and then you all can ask questions, and I'll get on to some of the other issues that you asked me to address. Does that work for you?
Fine. And,
okay.
And so
great.
For each one of the presenters, if you just give us your name and your position, and then your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Benton. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In that capacity, I serve as Alaska's Commissioner on the Pacific Salmon Commission. I represent the state of Alaska at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. I also represent the state of Alaska in various international negotiations with Japan, Russia, sometimes Poland, China, Korea, on different matters that affect the North Pacific and the Bering Sea and our fisheries. You had asked that I comment specifically, I think, on what has happened with the Pacific Salmon Treaty.
Yes.
As you know, we have a new agreement with Canada. It was a long time in the making. That was an extremely contentious issue for a number of years. Ferry blockades, transit fees, all kinds of fun and games like that with our friends in Canada. But we have a long-term agreement with them now. For Alaska, it's at least 10 years long. That agreement did two things, two very large things. One, it settled our disagreement with Canada. It also settled many of our disagreements with the southern United States. That was also a big component of what we were trying to accomplish. The arrangements with Canada include fishing regimes for Southeast Alaska for 10 years. They are abundance-based fishing regimes on both the Canadian side and the U.S. side. I'm pleased to report that the way that these fishing regimes are structured, our commercial fishing industry is going to remain a viable economic entity in Southeast Alaska. I think we can look forward to having a healthy and sustainable salmon fishery, commercial industry, our recreational industry, and our personal use and subsistence fisheries. I feel very good about that. If you have specific questions on any particular fishery, I'd be happy to answer that. The other component with Canada was establishing what we call a northern fund. The geographic area that this fund would cover is stretches from central British Columbia to the Yakutat area. It's the treaty area. The fund would be capitalized initially by the United States to the tune of about $75 million. It's an endowment. It will be administered by a committee of three Alaskans, which are specified in federal statute already, and then three Canadians. The Canadians have to appoint their folks. The monies from the endowment, the earnings, can be used for scientific research, habitat restoration work, and minimal kinds of enhancement activities, not large-scale new concrete and mortar hatcheries, but more low-tech operations to restore wild stocks. The opportunities there, I think, are quite broad, and I think we're going to see the ability to use those funds both in Canada and in Southeast Alaska to help address a lot of real pressing issues. And more importantly, to build a working relationship with our Canadian neighbors that hopefully when these 10-year fishing arrangements start winding down and we have to renegotiate, whoever the lucky person is that gets to do that will not be facing such a contentious set of issues as maybe we did in the past few years. In terms of resolving the domestic issues between us and the southern United States, we had the Endangered Species Act. We had the tribal stipulations with the Northwest Treaty Indian Tribes. We had the voting structure of the Pacific Salmon Commission, the U.S. section itself. The way that the U.S. section works or has been working up to now is that you have a commissioner from Alaska, a commissioner from Washington, and a commissioner from the tribes, and then each one of those individuals has an alternate. It is by consensus that the U.S. section makes a decision. And it was constructed in such a way that the southern commissioners voted on our fisheries and we would vote on their fisheries. that was causing some real problems, especially for Alaska, where the southern U.S. was trying to use us as political trading stock in their dealings with Canada. So one of the things that we were successful in doing was getting the Congress to separate the voting structure. And now, with the exception of Chinook salmon and coho salmon, all of our fisheries, the decisions on our fisheries are made by me, or whoever's the Pacific Salmon Commissioner for Alaska, and South has nothing to do with that. That's going to be a big improvement for us. On the Endangered Species Act questions, our fisheries were minimally impacting some of the listed stocks from southern U.S., but that was potentially could have a big impact on our fisheries. What we were able to secure was a long-term biological finding of no jeopardy, that our fisheries were not causing jeopardy to these endangered stocks, and we got legislation through the Congress as part of this package that limits the ability of National Marine Fisheries Service to reopen that issue without going through a number of steps, including looking at other factors that are affecting those stocks before they come back to Alaska and ask us to pay another price again. In other words, we took our reductions and made our deal with Canada. That satisfied the Endangered Species Act, and we got into law that the federal government couldn't come back at us again without dealing with other issues first. And the final matter that we dealt with were the series of lawsuits that had been filed by the Northwest Indian Treaty Tribes, primarily to resolve allocations in the South, but they were trying to get Alaska involved in those. These were the Bolt Treaty decisions. And we were able to secure stipulations in court through negotiations with the tribes that hold our fisheries harmless and hold Alaska harmless, at least for the life of this agreement, and in some instances well beyond that. So as a package, I think that we resolved a big chunk of the problems that Alaska was facing in this whole Pacific Salmon Treaty arena, and in doing so, we use that as a way to satisfy or get satisfaction and protect ourselves with some of these domestic issues that we're swirling around them as well.
And maybe I'd ask one question here on this subject matter. First of all, recognizing our distinguished and senior member, Representative Barnes, has joined us here. And Representative Barnes, we're talking about the U.S.-Canada Treaty, and they're getting an overview of the department. And the question that I have is this Northern Fund, which is largely coming from Congress, is that correct?
That's correct.
Approximately $75 million?
Correct.
How does that money flow? Does it flow in as a part of federal funds to the state, and then, how do we appropriate that money out to the, say, the Canadian interest and the lower 48 interest and Alaska's interest?
The way that the fund was structured, Mr. Chairman, is an appropriation that goes to a special fund that is housed in the Pacific Salmon Commission. And it's managed, if you would, pursuant to a trust agreement between the United States government and the Canadian government. And the administration of those monies is, as I mentioned earlier, is through a committee. We call it the Northern Fund Committee, which is composed of three U.S. citizens and three Canadian citizens. In federal statute, when the fund was created, they named the three U.S. Fund Committee members. One of them is the Pacific Salmon Commissioner, the other one is the alternate commissioner, and the third person is the regional director for National Marine Fisheries Service here in Alaska. So it really isn't something that comes through the legislature. It's a fund that's administered under the Pacific Salmon Treaty structure.
Is it similar to the Exxon Valdez Trust? Would that be a good analogy?
In some ways, yes, with a slightly different administrative process, but sure.
As far as the money is concerned, we never see those monies either. We'd like to, but we don't.
Correct.
But Mr. Chairman, I think that we would still have to have in our budget the authority to receive those funds. So you would see, if we were doing a project using
Correct.
These funds, if
So you would submit a project for funding to the legislature and go through the budget
and you'd have to agree that that was a good
So that's how the legislature provides oversight into the projects.
That's correct.
Right.
Thank you. Go ahead and proceed, sir.
Really, that's about what I have to say about, you know, the Pacific Salmon Treaty process. We've got a long-term agreement. We're in the process of trying to implement it. It's very complex. It's, in some ways, having now gone through the negotiations and now trying to go through the negotiations on how to make the thing work, I'd prefer it the other way around in some ways.
Yeah.
But we will be working with, you know, the U.S. South and Canada to just make the thing function. But it's the one good thing, if I could, the one good thing about this agreement, what's very different about this agreement than what was struck in 1985 when the treaty was first signed, is that we answered a number of fundamental questions in a very specific manner instead of sort of general feel-good language and concepts. It all had to be fleshed out. So we know pretty specifically what the fisheries are supposed to do to meet the obligations under the treaty. And if we run the fisheries in accordance with the way we put these together, when you get the end of the road, you don't wind up in a situation where Canada's saying, well, we owe you a bunch of fish, because that question has been answered. That's a very fundamental difference. And then we also tried to build into the agreement mechanisms to almost force cooperation between ourselves and Canada so that there's a better working relationship, and institutionally and professionally relationships can be built over time so that they're not just always at loggerheads and it's an us versus them. I think it's a real important change.
It sounds refreshing to me. Two things that you brought up was that you've adopted the abundance-based concept in the treaty. These folks at this table have over the years expressed interest in abundance-based game populations and fish populations so that we never have a shortage. You might give us just a little bit of a better understanding of what you think that means, and if you could tie that and maybe the whole essence or development of the treaty to the current change in our subsistence management.
I'm going to have a problem with. But I think, describe very briefly how the abundance-based approach is different than what was being done in the past. Under previous treaty arrangements in specific fisheries, there were fixed quotas or fixed amounts of fish that would be harvested. For example, if you take the Noyes Island seine fishery, the specific obligation was 480,000 sockeye over 4 years or 120,000 sockeye a year in a specific period of time, and that was it, irrespective of what the population was doing. So if you had huge numbers of sockeye, you're still limited by that number of, you know, 120,000 or so, which caused lots of management difficulties. And similarly, if the population was very low, that 120 became a target. What we have now is a formula based on stock status, monitored in season, that says here's basically how we're going to determine how many fish to catch, and that number rises and falls in relation to the status of the stocks. It's much more conservation-oriented, especially in years of low abundance. In years of high abundance, you know, you can pick up a little extra benefit, and so there's a share the pain, share the gain kind of approach that's in there.
Mr. Chen, if I could jump in here, I think the other important thing we did is we exported the concept of abundance-based management to the South, and maybe David can fill you in. They were not necessarily managing for sustained yield or hitting their harvest targets based on the abundance of the population. They were sometimes fishing for political reasons.
If you're going to speak to the subsistence issue, you certainly are willing to. I'm willing to wait and hear the whole. You know,
I was going to do that.
I think others are going to talk about that.
And you don't have to, piecemeal it here. I'd ask anybody in the committee that has any questions of David, co-chair.
Thank you. You said you reached a new agreement. Is there something on paper that you can share with the committee members?
How how thick a stack
synopsis
do you want? You want the summary?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. We have that in our office, and I can make that available to the whole committee. That'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you.
The chair will see that we get a copy for everybody and transmit it. Any other questions?
All right.
Want to proceed, sir?
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, the other set of issues that were highlighted for me were oriented around the North Pacific Fishery Management Council process and what's going on with halibut at the council. If there are other questions members have for me about what's going on at North Pacific Council, I'd be happy to answer them, but I'll stick to that particular issue. As you're probably aware, the North Pacific Council over the past several years has been off and on looking at the issue of management of charter halibut fisheries. And this issue first surfaced, I think, in 91 or 92, and it came up sporadically over the course of a number of years. The state has tried various ways of addressing the matter without going to a very specific guideline harvest level arrangement. In 1995, though, despite our vote, the council did adopt a guideline harvest level. It was based on 125% of the 1995 charter halibut harvest, which was at the time the highest year of harvest by the charter boats. So they would get 125% of their highest year. And it never was really implemented because management measures were not also adopted that were very specific on how you would then manage the fishery. The matter has come up again at the council level. This time, I think there will be a guideline harvest level arrangement put into place. The goal of the state of Alaska is to ensure that arrangement is fair, that it is constructed in a manner that is not a penalty or penalize the charter fishery, allows for a modest room of growth in the charter fishery, especially in some of our more remote communities that don't have recreational fisheries industry presently, but are interested maybe in getting into that. We are interested in having an arrangement that is implementable, that is actually workable. We want to make sure that we don't do something that is just not going to work. So we're trying to guide the process in that manner, and that it's something that's minimally disruptive to the normal operations that the charter industry would conduct. The GHL would apply in areas 2C and 3A. Those areas are basically southeast Alaska and then south central down to sort of the Kodiak area. GHL would not affect personal use or recreational non-charter fishers. They would be able to go out and just conduct their activities in the way that they normally do, or subsistence.
Can you describe that area generally for the record?
Well, that just means that those individuals that go out fishing recreationally, for example, for halibut, they would not be under a limit.
Not implicated.
They are not touched by this. It's just strictly charter boats. The options that are currently in front of the council include either the 1995 as a base or up to 1998, which was the highest year now. And 125% of 1998. There are no options in front of the council that would shut down the charter fishery. There are management measures that are being considered that would range from everything from simple limits on whether or not the captain and crew could keep halibut while they have clients on board, to perhaps the most draconian measure, which would be a one fish bag limit throughout the season. What the department has been looking at in terms of those management measures is how and under what conditions would those be applied, and how would you do that in a manner that's least disruptive to the charter fleet and to their operations. And I think I can tell you with some surety that things like a one fish bag limit throughout the season are not something that you're going to see being applied in that fishery in anywhere near the in the near future. It would be a very draconian measure and would be used if only if the fishery got way out of compliance with the level that would be specified.
I could interrupt you just for a moment because Mr. Vice Chair had a question on this.
Yeah, since you're talking about the charter sport fishermen or that use charters to catch for their own personal use, I'd like you to go over again how you're protecting their interest in that, if you could.
Well, let's see. Let me see if I can phrase this correctly. The first, in Representative Cowdery, in Area 2C in Southeast Alaska, just by way of information, the non-Alaskan component of that harvest is about, I think it's in the 95 or so percentage, about 5% maybe or less are Alaskans from our local communities. The vast majority are visitors to Alaska. That doesn't make their interest any less than an Alaskan, really, but just thought that would be useful because when you compare 2C to Area 3A, which is in South Central, that number changes, and it's about 30-35% Alaskans that use the services of the charter fleet to go out and actually catch their halibut.
Right. Then follow up on the charter. Like myself, I have my own boat, as many people do. Do you have a percentage that don't use charters, but that how do you protect those interests too?
Sure. A fellow like yourself that has his own boat and goes out and catches
two boats.
Can I have one?
Yeah.
I'm sure. Bring it down here. We'll all use it.
You're not affected by this. The non-guided or non-charter recreational halibut fisherman is just, you just conduct your business the way you normally would.
Sport fishing.
The two fish bag
limit. You'd have a two fish bag limit, and that's the way it goes. The charter vessels and the use by charter clients would be limited by a number, and we're looking at, as I mentioned, an overall range between what was actually caught in 1995 to 125% of 1998. All of those are very high years in terms of the charter catch. And in that instance, for example, if, let's say, in a year, the charter fleet exceeded their guideline harvest level by 10%, what we're currently looking at as a council, and of course this is all still, you know, a decision that has to be made, but the kinds of things you'd be looking at the council would probably be something as simple as the skippers and the crew could not keep halibut while they're out on a charter with clients, depending on which area you're looking at. I'm thinking right now here, if it went up a little higher than that, say it went up to 20%, you're over the guideline harvest level of 20%, what might occur is a measure that says the skippers and crew could not retain halibut, as I previously described, plus there might be an annual bag limit, and I can't remember the exact number, but I want to say it's like annual bag limit of 7 halibut or something on that order.
Maybe on that point, before you go any further here, Madam Co-Chair, you had a question on that point?
Well, I wanted to know how long his discussion is going to go in.
Almost done.
Halibut, then I have a list of questions I'd like to ask.
Okay. There's only one more point that I wanted to make. That is that whatever scheme comes out of the council process, in addition to being fair and being implementable and having minimal disruption in the charter industry, the other thing that we are looking for, in keeping with our overall principle, is for it to be based in some manner, have an abundance-based component so that the fishery is conducted in a manner that also respects conservation and meets you know, sort of meets those standards. We didn't want to have something that was just a fixed allocation with no abundance based component, because that gets you in trouble, as I mentioned earlier, with the salmon treaty fisheries that we were dealing with. So that's it.
And any other questions on this halibut?
Yeah,
issue?
On the halibut. You know, you talk about charter. Do you know in South Central, do you have a percentage on, say I'm facing Whittier, of course, and I know Homer is a big commercial or charter thing. But do you have any percentage of what is caught by, say, private owners, boat owners versus charter owners?
A percentage of the overall recreational catch?
Yes, in South Central.
Yeah, we've got that. I don't have that in my head. I don't know, Kevin, if you have.
We have it by charter and uncharter.
I'd like to have that information if possible.
Sure, that's it. Yeah. Better make a list.
We'll see that that's provided as well. And we'll now. You have some questions, Madam Co-Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The North Pacific Management Council, are they scheduled to meet in Anchorage later this month? I'd like to know, are there any sport fishing interests represented on the council?
There is a, there is.
It's a yes or a no?
Well, it's a yes. But I was going to explain it in some, and maybe in some. There's two management agencies, of course, that manage recreational fisheries. And frankly, whenever I get up there, I sort of consider myself to be somebody that represents sport interests. But that aside, there's one Alaskan council member who's involved in a halibut charter business out of Dutch Harbor, and is also that particular. Company or group that he's involved with is looking at building a lodge in Nikolski right now. And that's his specific interest. And a number of the council members all go fishing. And that's, you know, but they are, I don't know, you could say that they represent recreational interests, but they certainly understand recreational interests.
So what is the department doing to protect the sport fishing interests?
Well, as I described earlier, I think what we're trying to do is come up with an arrangement that is fair, that provides for some modest amount of growth in the recreational fishery, and that's implementable, and is, can be done in a manner that is with minimal disruption to the charter fleet. The other thing that we've done is we've made sure, and I've done this now for a number of years as a state representative, is that we have recreational representation on our advisory panel, both a non-charter recreational fisher from Alaska and a charter recreational representative. None of the other states that are on the council have that kind of representation, and I make sure that those folks are there and they're plugged in and talk to them quite a bit.
And I think the other important thing to remember is that the folks who go and catch halibut themselves don't use a charter operation. The Alaskans that do that, they aren't even under this cap, so we're looking out for their interests too, as well as subsistence use.
Well, and going back to your point on how it doesn't really affect us, well, it does in a way, because I don't own a boat and I don't have the equipment to go down and put a boat out and, you know, hunt or fish for halibut, and so we are being impacted, because I would have to go to a charter boat to go out and fish for halibut, so I would be impacted by it.
You and 35% of the rest of the charter catch are definitely in that loop, and we're well aware of that. That's why we're trying to look at this in the manner that we are.
Do you have any numbers on the percentage of halibut caught as bycatch and waste in the commercial fisheries?
I've got that. I've got it back at the office. I don't have it. I can't recall it offhand. And I can get it to you by year group and by area if you want.
Would that number include long line and trawl fisheries?
Yeah, it'd be broken out by year type.
Okay.
I mean, I can provide it that way if you want.
Regarding the bycatch, is it long lining typically a high or a low bycatch fishery?
Overall, you mean with relation to the rest of the groundfish fisheries? I'd say that long line is a sort of medium to low bycatch fishery for halibut relative to, say, bottom trawling. But the pot fisheries, say, pot cod fisheries are lower yet than long line fisheries are. And it really varies by area and species that's being pursued. That's why I've got a reasonably good report for you that provides all the bycatch data for 95 to, I think, 97 or 98, by area, by gear type, by species, by fisheries. It's pretty comprehensive.
Well, just along that same line, too, do you have any idea what other species are taken as bycatch in that fishery?
The longline fishery, there's any number of species that are taken as bycatch. Rock fishes.
Or the trawl fishery.
Oh, it's a long list. Again, depending on which fishery you're talking about, it's primary. Let's focus on the longline fishery for just a moment. In that fishery, it's primarily rock fishes, some lingcod. Depending on if you're fishing for other fisheries, maybe some peacod. Trawl fisheries, if it's a midwater pollock fishery in the Bering Sea, it's probably 95 to 98% pollock by volume. So as a rate, it's very low. You get into some of the flatfish fisheries on the bottom, and the bycatch can be very high. And you look, for example, in the Bering Sea rock sole fishery, which is little flatfish guys are right on the bottom. They have to fish for them right hard on bottom. Those fisheries, they have up to 60 or plus percentage bycatch rates. Very high, not a real clean fishery. But we do have all that information. And frankly, one of the goals that the state has had for a long time, and I've been involved with the council process for almost 14 years, and I've been sitting there for about five in the state seat, is to promote cleaner fishing practices and try and move those guys off the bottom, try and reduce bycatches, not just for prohibited species like halibut or crab, but also discard waste and mortality of other kinds of marine life, marine mammals, seabirds, and some of the fisheries. We've been reasonably successful in doing that, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Co-chair, another question? For the record, I want to make sure, Mike, just interject for a minute here. I want to make sure that we're able to get this exchange back and forth as to who's saying what to whom for the record. We're just communicating back and forth here, and I think for the record at this stage, it's the co-chair, Mr.
Right.
Benton. And if there's other questions where the commissioner might, if you could just say your name, please, for the record, so we can keep the record straight. Madam Chair.
It seems quite obvious to me that with the bycatch and the waste by the commercial fisheries is a lot higher than the sport fishery arena. And I'm just wondering, why is it that the sport fishery has to limit their catch while the commercial industry is not being impacted or changed with their catch as well? So I see there's a bigger waste in that area than, the small percentage that's being taken by the sport fishermen. And what will you do to try to even that out so that the sport fishery, which only take a small percentage, don't have to bleed all the time for that. And on the issue of myself or someone from Trapper Creek or Talkeetna that wanted to go down to Homer and get on a charter boat And if they, if the cash is limited to one day and they spend, you know, all that money just to go out and they catch just a 35-pound halibut, then they're going to have to spend additional money to go back out to try to get a bigger halibut so that they can put that away in their freezer. So I just, it's going to be a really devastating impact on Alaskan residents that, you know, do go down, and not just for the sport part of it, but to really take that halibut home and put it in their freezer to eat.
Chairman. Bye.
Awesome.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I agree with you, and that's why, as I mentioned previously, and it started long before this issue with the sport or the charter boat restrictions ever began, the state has been working very hard to try and secure provisions both in the Magnuson Act and at the council that reduce bycatches across the board, different kinds of species. We've been successful in reducing that bycatch substantially. It's not perfect, and there's a lot of work still to be done. We're somewhat limited in some ways because of national standards in the Magnuson Act and also the willingness of the federal government to do their job on some of these, but that's a different discussion. Because at the council, what we do is we make recommendations to the Secretary of Commerce. Secretary of Commerce implements those recommendations or not, and sometimes we have been more successful than others. But I agree with you, and you know, that's in part why we're looking, we the state are looking at the this guideline harvest level in the way that we are. And I'll go back to the basic principles that we're looking at, which are that it's got to be fair, it's got to be implementable, all that, and we're trying to do it in a way that's minimally disruptive to those businesses, and by virtue of that, you know, hopefully it'll be as minimally disruptive to Alaskans who want to use those as possible. And part of that, we're going to have, because there's very different characteristics between 3A, which is sort of the South Central area, and what's going on in 2C, I would not be surprised to see somewhat different measures in the two areas, because they really are a different management problem. You don't have this as much in 3A, but in 2C, in some areas, we have some pretty significant sort of user conflicts. Oftentimes, those conflicts are more between charter boats and other recreational fishers than it is between charter boats and commercial fishing. And the mechanism that we have tried to promote at the state level is local area management plans. We think that's a better way of dealing with a lot of those problems. And what we're trying to do is, when the GHL is established, is to do that in a manner that allows the formation of these what we call LAMPs, local area management plans, these LAMPs in a way that really address some of those very specific problem areas. And hopefully that'll work out. But I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree with the message at all.
Just on that note, yes, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate hearing the positive communication on this issue, because it will really impact, you know, residents and the resource that is here in the state. You know, it belongs to Alaskan residents, and we have to try to treat it fair as possible. So I really appreciate hearing what you plan to do, and I look forward to getting a report on your meeting later on this month. And thank you for trying and saying that you can understand the problem. That's really great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vice Chair?
Yeah, Mr. President Cowdery. You're talking about the longliners and the trawlers and different. What's the normal depth that the longliners, say, fish like for halibut and cod? And
They fish, they fish anywhere between pretty darn shallow areas. I mean, you know, maybe 100 feet, 200 feet, anywhere down to, you know, several. How long would the I would, you know, 600-700 fathoms, maybe. I mean, it's deep, and the trawlers go very deep. Some of them go very deep in Bering Sea and off the shelf.
What, a little bit follow-up. What is the normal depth that you catch cod, for instance? What's the prime depth, the black cod? Or?
Well, that really depends on the area you're fishing in and the time of year. And if I'm struggling, it's because it really does vary a bunch. I instead of venturing a guess, what I'd really would like to do is go back and put some information together for you on those fisheries and get it to
you. I'd appreciate it if you'd have it to the committee so we could all share and distinguish the long lines, liners and trawlers, what, as much as you can. I'd just like to have that information.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. And any other species for rockfish or... I know that most of the fish, or a lot of fish where I do, they go on at the bottom, but the bottom could be 70 feet to 700 feet, you know.
Yes, please, 1,000 feet.
I'll be happy to provide you with the information. There's always a danger, though, Representative Cowdery, of asking me for information because I usually try and give you way too much, but I'll try and keep it to a dull roar.
Well, we appreciate it.
Roar is better.
I want to go there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. It might, you know, I can see something that would be very useful to us, which would be educational, and might even at least give us just a little bit of the embodiment of the council, who they are and under what law they operate under. I don't want anybody assuming that the state has control or management authority that they don't have, and I think it's important for us to understand, you know, how hidebound we are, if you will, by federal law, and who some of the other players are on the council, and who makes those appointments and things of that nature. Because when we're talking about, you know, the bycatch and all of those kinds of things, it's a major issue, but it's, in many respects, these kind of fisheries have got a dominant control by federal law and by federal appointees. And Alaska has, what, one member?
Yeah, one vote.
One vote. And one member on that council. So any ideas that you have, Matt, co-chair, that you want him to take back to that council to represent your interest and your constituents' interest, I would suggest that you put it down in writing and that you send it to him officially and ask that he take it in your behalf before that council to represent your interest.
And
certainly the comments that we've had here and the testimony here, you'll be taking that back, so she's already transmitted at that point in time.
Thank you.
Would you, Mr. Chairman, would 200-mile limit and set up these councils to administer fisheries outside of state jurisdiction? So basically it's from 3 to 200 miles. In some instances, either the Magnuson Act or other federal law preempts state management within 3 miles. And in this particular instance, we're just talking about on halibut. Halibut's managed pursuant to the International Halibut Convention with Canada and the Halibut Act. The Halibut Act specifically designates the North Pacific Council as managing halibut throughout the range in Alaska. So that's from the beach and on out. So the state has no management authority over halibut. What we do with halibut is we adopt complementary regulations inside 3 miles and work with the federal government in terms of enforcement kinds of measures, but that's about it. The North Pacific Council is set up so that there are 11 voting members. There's the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service here in Alaska, the regional director for Alaska, has a vote. The director for Washington State Department of Fisheries, or his or her designee, has a vote. The commissioner of Fish and Game for Alaska, or his designee, has a vote. That's myself. And then the director for fisheries for the state of Oregon has a representative, and that person has a vote. Then the rest are public members that are appointed by the Secretary of Commerce from lists submitted by different governors. And there's two from Washington State. The public members, Governor of Washington, submits a list of 6 names, and they are chosen. They have staggered terms. And in Alaska, there's 5 members. Again, staggered terms. They're appointed by the Secretary of Commerce, and there's a list of each time one of those comes up, we have to submit three names for each one of those appointments. But those are federal appointments, and I can tell you that those folks are very independent in their voting, and they make up their own mind on a lot of issues, and it's an interesting forum to work in. The council process is spelled out very explicitly in federal law, and we are obligated to follow what are called the national standards and guidelines. Those standards and guidelines are very specific in limiting or the council's authority. For example, we can't allocate fish based on residency. Can't just say, okay, Alaskans get 50% of all the halibut, for example. That violates national standards. Probably also violates all kinds of other U.S. law, but, you know, we just can't. The council, when it makes a decision, that decision is simply a recommendation to the Secretary of Commerce. In the end, the Secretary of Commerce has to either accept, reject, or reject in part council recommendation, with one exception, and that's any limited entry program. The Secretary of Commerce has to either accept it or reject it. The Secretary of Commerce cannot reject it in part. And so when you get down to it, while we have some influence there, we don't have control there at all, and it can be a rough and tumble kind of a game, as I'm sure you have had experience with around here every once in a while.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say that we're always in that situation, it seems like, that I trust you'll do a good job in representing Alaska, and sometimes if you got to be a bulldog, you just have to do it. So good luck, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair.
Just to clear up, I don't want you to go doing a lot of research. What I was interested in when I was asking about cod and halibut and all the other fish was not what every fisherman does, but what the pro knows, where they're at, you know, what do the pros look for? I mean, I know fishermen go...
He wants a map.
He wants to know where.
In his area.
I know. Believe me, I know Prince William Sound.
Oh, okay. You want to... Okay.
But I would just like the long line. I don't think we have too much longliners, maybe a few. I haven't seen too many there. A few.
I've not a lot of Prince William Sound.
In the west side, yeah. But I'd just like to know, say, in cod and, you know, what they look for in ideal depths and things like that. I don't want you to waste a lot of time on stuff. But, you
know. We didn't want a budget increment.
You read my mind.
They can always say, I have to have a budget increment because the vice chair has asked for a... manufacture all this information.
Chair, I think the vice chairman is looking.
You have to leave. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Unless you have other questions for me.
If there's any last questions of Mr. Benton before he leaves, Representative Harris, did you have a question?
No.
All right. Anything? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Very educational. That's one reason we like to start these sessions out with sort of an update, if you will, on what's going on in the departments that we have oversight responsibility for. Commissioner, if you'd go ahead and proceed, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I thought I'd touch on a couple of other issues, and then you all can ask me questions, or I can have other folks come up to the table and answer specific questions. One of the issues that's faced the department, as you all are aware, is the developing fisheries issue. There are a number of potential fisheries out there that we haven't developed, that are not ongoing, and we've had an experience in the state of, and we've seen it around the world, where we've opened fisheries without adequate information, and they've basically been overfished, and they disappear. And so the department has been very reluctant, and the Board of Fish has been very reluctant to open new fisheries unless we've got adequate stock assessment information and a management structure in place to deal with the fishery.
Examples, Commissioner, of some of the...
We've got things like clams, sea snails, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, gooey ducks, kelp, spiny dogfish. I mean, there are lots of potential out there, some of which are in the process of being developed now, but ones we call developing fisheries. Some of them we have not, we don't have fisheries on. So what we have started to do over the last year or so is work with industry to come up with a way that we will, and a policy for developing these fisheries and certain standards and criteria we would want to make sure we've met, and have these kind of criteria and rules understandable to the industry that we want to make sure we've met before we open some of these new fisheries. We want to make sure that the public understands how we're going to go after and prosecute these new fisheries. We also want to make sure that if we do open new fisheries, we can manage them consistent with sustained yield, and also try and structure them so they benefit Alaskans and local communities, because I think what we're seeing in our fisheries around the state is diversification is going to be important for people to survive in the fishing industry. A lot of fishermen can't just make it on one species and or fishery. And so the more opportunities we can provide, perhaps in some smaller fisheries, localized fisheries, could be the thing that allows fishermen to succeed financially and continue to fish other species as well. So we see it as a potential benefit to the state. We've got a draft plan. We've been working with the public. I've got Jaron Bruce here, who's been the lead for this project during the off-season when you all aren't in town, and working with the industry. I can provide copies of that plan as far as it is for you all to look at your leisure. And if you have questions, you can bring them to me, or I could have Jaron come up and talk specifically about some of the issues. I think the sea urchin fishery maybe and the dive association that you all helped form is a good example of how industry and the department are working together to come up with some new and developing fisheries. You see the fishermen taxing themselves, assessing themselves for and forming an association to do that, so that there are the funds to do the stock assessments. We know how much is out there, and then manage the fishery. We also are putting some general funds into the dive fishery. So it's a joint effort with the industry. So it's that kind of experience I think we're going to have to pursue as general funds get tighter. If we're going to pursue some of these opportunities, we're going to have to come up with some new ways of finding ways to fund these opportunities. So if you'd like, I could have Jaron come up, or we can go on to some other issues. But that's what we're working on, and glad to answer questions.
Just for a minute.
Staff, if there was, I thought I recollected that there was some legislation that dealt with the dive fisheries, and it appears as though it's a financial, it's how the collection and maintenance and dispersing of the funding, I think. And so if there's any specific interest here, we can schedule a specific, it might be interesting for some, particularly some of the new members here, to have an understanding or some sort of an idea of just exactly what these developing or emerging new fisheries really are and what potential they may have to the economics of the state. If you have maybe kind of a quick look at it, and then perhaps we could even follow up at some point in time with, I know a lot of folks may not have a good understanding what geoid ducks are and sea urchins and the snails and a lot of those kind of things, and where the markets are for them. You don't need to get into that, but if you could just kind of give us an idea of what some of these are and how you're proceeding and who you're proceeding with. Who are the advocates from the Alaska population that you interact with or that you deal with?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Doug Meekham, the Director of Commercial Fisheries. He can...
Chairman.
Thank you, Doug.
Mr. Vice Chair. I don't mean to interrupt, but I would like, before we run out of time, to talk a little bit about hunting.
Hunting?
Yeah, the hunting, you know, game hunting and things like that, too.
Okay. I don't know that we had, I thought that we were going to do that when Madam Co-Chair would probably bring up the game side of it. If we have an opportunity, though, John, we'll do that. Let's get on through the fishery side of this here, of the fish side of the fish and game, and then Representative Masick, I'm sure, is going to bring up like wolf control and a lot of other types of issues that deal with the critters.
I appreciate you calling me a young man.
Yeah.
we can always come back if we run out of time today. I know Wayne Reglan was here, so we can come back and discuss other.
I think that would be beneficial, Commissioner.
Whatever works for you.
But if you could, while we're on this, these new developing fisheries, just kind of let us know what's out there, who's calling for what, how you're proceeding with it.
Thank you,
Mr. Sort of a summary, if you would, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I can be fairly brief. I guess I would just give you some of the examples that we're currently in the developmental process of, and that's sea urchin fishery here in southeast Alaska. Starting about 5 or 6 years ago, we started down this road of developing a management plan, the stock assessment plan for that fishery, and it was done as a partnership with private industry. In fact, private industry came forward and actually gave us the funding to start that process. Subsequent to that, the legislature has given us a developing fisheries CIP, which is essentially what is funding this project that we're currently doing on getting this policy done. And also, it's also been assisting the Southeast Alaska Dive Association in keeping their association going. That fishery is particularly attractive, I think, because it's fairly labor-intensive, so it means a lot of jobs. If you go down to a place like Ketchikan, you know, any given processor might have 30 or 40 people working a line, extracting the roe. It's also got a lot of value-added aspects to it. The roe itself, the sea urchin is harvested for its roe, the egg skeins, and it's a fairly low value for that roe, but by the time it, let's say 40 or 50 cents a pound, by the time you get to Japan, it's multiplied by 100 times. And in this particular fishery, you have a lot of transportation costs. So you see a lot of jobs that are created for local communities. There's a lot of spin-off economic benefits for the transportation industry, et cetera. So we've tried to make that fishery slow-paced so that it's not a derby-style fishery, that it creates a lot of jobs for these local communities. And it's still getting off its feet, but I think it has a lot of promise. Another fishery is the sea cucumber fishery. Both of those species, the main market is in Japan, and they're both harvested by divers, and that fishery is essentially fully developed here in southeast Alaska. We're looking at other opportunities around the state, all the way out to the Aleutian chain, in fact, and we have gone to the federal government and received roughly $1.2 million last year and another $1.25 million this year for the development of what we call nearshore fisheries and sea urchins. Is one example of that. I guess I'd stop there.
Can you give us just a rough idea of what kind of dollar value on a statewide basis is the sea urchin business in Alaska? What potentials do we have out there? How many, what kind of bucks?
Mr. Chairman, the southeast sea urchin fishery, I think it's been in the neighborhood of $1 to $3 or $4 million. Just in terms of ex-vessel value. And again, the spin-off economic benefits are very great. Perhaps multiply that by 5 or 10 times in terms of retail. And we don't really know what the potential is for the rest of the state. We know that there are a lot of green urchins in some areas out the chain, and we're working, in fact, with the Aleutian people out on the chain at PITCA. I can't remember what the acronym exactly stands for, but we're working with them right now and seeing if we can develop that fishery out there, which they're trying to build up their economies in places like ADAC. We're working with them.
Senator Jewell, on the sea urchins, the market for that, is that outside the state, overseas, comes back to Alaska? Where's the market for it?
Chairman Representative Jewell, primarily Japan, but there is a domestic market in California as well. It's a sushi or sashimi-type market.
Mr. On that point?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I was going to give a little bit of context here. We think these developing fisheries are important, but not at the expense of some of our very, very important ongoing fisheries. And so we've tried to maintain salmon as the backbone for a lot of communities and places. We've tried to maintain our capabilities for salmon. We've also got a number of fisheries around the state that are probably underdeveloped, if you will, as a term, or we don't have enough information on it. These are very significant fisheries. Our Opelio fishery, some of the crab stocks in around the state, shrimp. There are a number of very valuable, potentially very valuable fisheries where we don't think we have got adequate Finance Committee will see a non-general fund, but a proposal to increase our stock assessment and other management capabilities in some of these fisheries around the state that we sort of consider our ongoing economic engine, but they really need some investment to do a better job, make sure we have maximum opportunity. And these are things like shrimp, crab, et cetera. So we can't forget the things we're doing well now or the things we should do better. We also, though, want to develop some of these new opportunities. Not rob Peter to pay Paul and just lose what we've got.
I think it's a very good point. You know, we often look at our business as legislators in trying to maintain some sort of cost-effective control over the expenditures in state government. And whenever you can develop new employment and economic opportunities and interests in the state of Alaska, particularly that are paid for by the industry itself, I think that's very important to policymakers as well. So as these develop, we need to be educated and informed as well so we can, you know, help support new jobs and more money into our communities and let the Japanese buy all this product and hire our people and that money circulate into our communities. That's what we like. So thank you.
Okay. Shall I go ahead with some other issues?
I want to proceed. If there's any other questions, first of all,
you can bring Doug back up if later on there are questions of him. I know he enjoys being on the hot seat.
Representative Harris? Hold on for a minute, please.
Thank you. You know, one of the most important things I think that we can do right now in a time of where the legislature is continuing to look at reducing the cost of government and, you know, various different industries are having a tough time, the timber industry in Southeast, and mining is pretty good in Alaska but doesn't give the state a lot of money. What is the department doing or what can the legislature do, in your opinion, to help to promote the commercial fishing industry, which does do its share, I think, to put money into the coffers of the state. Much of the fishing industry is monies that the state gives them. They collect themselves from the fishermen, that sort of thing. Can you give us a little idea? I think one of the things that I certainly want to do as a legislator is try to promote and develop our industries in the state, all of the industries, and fishing is certainly one of the main ones. Can you give us a little direction or idea of what you're trying to do, especially in times of reduction in budgets and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harris, I think the fundamental thing I think the legislature can do is to make sure we've got an adequate management program. I think the last has been incredibly successful in maintaining opportunities for folks in terms of particularly fisheries. And there's no secret that it takes money to manage these resources sustainably. And so one of the most important things you all can do is make sure we've got an adequate budget to run these programs. The fishermen have been very willing, commercial fishermen, very willing to participate in funding their own marketing in ASME, in participating in, you know, the hatchery program. They finance that, you know, the self-assessment on the sea urchins. They pay raw fish taxes. So I think the fishermen have been willing to contribute to the state coffers to make sure that, one, they you know, pay their dues as part of using the public resource, but also they contribute to management. And so I think that's the first thing I'd say the legislature could do that is helpful, is make sure we've got a good management program and not forget what it took to get us where we are. I think that to the extent that we can help educate folks about the value of the fishing industry, as well as sport fishing. I mean, sport fishing is a big economic engine. Tourism is a big economic engine in this state, and a lot of that's focused on fish and wildlife. So the whole issue of fish and wildlife is an economic issue for Alaskans, and so I think it's key to have adequate management programs and then help us for those legislators or those communities that don't have as obvious a connection to the economic importance of fishing and wildlife, help us figure out how to get that message to them. And I think folks from some of the Anchorage legislators, I don't think always understand how important
that economy is to their community. Some of the smaller communities, Petersburg, you don't have to go very far to find someone who knows how important fishing is, the economy of Petersburg. Some of the larger communities, I'm not sure they appreciate how important fish and wildlife are to the economy of their communities. And so the extent some of the legislators feel that we can help them understand the importance of it, and that would be great, too. Any feedback you can give us?
Thank you. Commissioner Representative Jewell, and then Captioner.
Thank you. Just a little bit of a soft rebut to a colleague across the table with regards to the legislature as a body and some of the continuing hunt for cuts, I guess it isn't. All members of the legislature who are looking in that direction, that's one. Commissioner, over the years in the process of, and I think you may have answered this already, but as it relates to fisheries, both our established fisheries and underdeveloped fisheries or new fisheries, with the budget cuts that have occurred over the years, and I'm just wondering the impact that has had in you being able to address some of these issues in emerging fisheries or managing fisheries in general.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Representative Jewell, I'll take a quick run at it, but I think really maybe Doug is better able. It has had an impact. I mean, an obvious one is our ability to develop the mariculture industry. Basically cut that program in half. We have one person trying to do that full time, and I think that's made it harder for us to work with that industry and get going. That's one small example. I think some of the fisheries I just mentioned, crab, shrimp, are ones where we have not done probably as much as we should because we don't have the budget. Doug, are there others you want to? I think some of our salmon programs, we're starting to lose our capabilities in some of our salmon programs.
Mr. Rankin, would you have some input on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the Commissioner covered it pretty well. We have tried to, with the budget cuts that we've faced in the Commercial Fisheries Division and the General Fund, it's been roughly about 30% General Fund reduction over the past 10 fiscal years. We are getting to the point, I think there's been a recognition of that by a lot of people, we're getting to the point where further significant reductions are going to erode our basic management capability. We've tried to maintain that to the best of our ability. I think we've done a pretty good job. Revenues to the Department of Fish and Game and Commercial Fisheries have been declining. We've been blessed by some extremely favorable environmental conditions. The fact of the matter is it's pretty easy to manage when things are going great. It's a lot more difficult when the survivals are going down and these populations are at lower levels. Errors that you make in management can have much more disastrous effects. So I think Representative Jewell raises a very valid concern, and it's certainly a concern of mine. And I guess we're just hopeful that for this industry that pays its own way, that we can try to maintain some level of stability. If nothing else.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I think a couple things we've done that have probably been smart. We've divested ourselves of hatcheries and had the private nonprofits run them. Now, that was a good way to probably save the state some money. We can still run them. But we've also been blessed, besides the favorable ocean conditions, with a senator in Washington who's pretty good at getting federal funding to support fisheries management in Alaska, and that won't always be there. We've also had, unfortunately, a couple of disasters economic disasters in Western Alaska that have provided some research funding to get at fundamental issues like coho, issues in the Kuskokwim that we should be doing, but we didn't have the budget to do it. So I think federal funding has actually come to our rescue in a number of these cases, and I think we're not doing enough in shellfish, crab, et cetera. So I think it's a combination of the federal funding has come to our rescue. We've made some smart cuts. We don't have limnology lab to understand what's going on in some of the productivity of lakes in Bristol Bay. We used to have some pretty good research on
limnology, which helps you manage your fisheries. That's gone, basically. We've got some limnologists who are paid for by the hatchery. So some of our ability to fundamentally understand the resource and manage to maximize opportunity is going away. And so federal funding has helped us. We've cut some programs. We've figured out some smart ways to have the private nonprofits deal with issues. But we're not doing a lot of things we should be.
We asked.
Yeah, you asked. Thank you, Mr.
Rustin Kepsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two comments and then a question. When you were talking about the economy, Commissioner Rue, I understand that today the seafood industry had a luncheon, and I don't know how many of the members of this committee went, but I didn't have a chance to go, but I talked to Representative Osterman, and he told me that a lot of business interests were there, NBA being one of them, and they announced at the luncheon that 40% of their business comes from the fishing industry, which I thought was quite remarkable and very noteworthy. My second comment has to do with the budget cuts. I used to work as a fisheries technician for the Bethel Test Fish Project under Doug Molyneux, and it was an experience that I really enjoyed because I got to understand the difficulties in managing a resource, and especially when our resource of fish is diminishing now. This year we experienced our fourth fish disaster, the worst ever, but the third consecutive and the fourth in 7 years, which has had a really negative impact on our community. One of the things that Doug Molyneux has tried to get in the past is in-season subsistence surveys so that he has a better understanding, and the working group there, the management group, has a better understanding of how much fish is being used by subsistence users. And it's just astounding how much fish is taken by subsistence users. And he'd been trying to get state funding, which, of course, there was no hope of that. So he wrote a grant to the federal government. And the federal government, it was under Magnus and Stevens money, and he was denied because the Fed said this is a state-managed, you know, we're under state management out there, and the state should be paying for that. So he gave the grant application to our tribe, ONC, the tribal government in Bethel, and it was awarded to the tribe. So under the tribe, I was able to help out in getting some of the subsistence data that we needed, and it was really, really, really beneficial for the working group to have that data. And it's just a shame that when we were under state management, you know, the state didn't find it a worthy enough project to fund. And I guess my question is under research, under the Magnus and Stevens money that we've received for research, last year when we spoke in this committee under this same overview, you said you didn't really know what we were going to do in terms of research. Can you tell me now what your plans are for finding out what is going on with our fishery and why we have disaster after disaster?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't have any. Our research plan is essentially in final form now, and I'd be happy to make that available. Roughly a third of the money is being spent in the Yukon-Kuskokwim areas, and that's out of a total grant from the federal government around $7 million, and we're spending about $2 million, a little over $2 million a year in a three-year CIP. So I guess rather than get into some of the specific details, perhaps I can just forward that to you. And then I would mention also that nothing breeds success like failure, I guess, because we just got another $5 million from the federal government for doing a similar sort of a research initiative in the Norton Sound and the Nome area. So just over the course of the past 2 years, we've received $12 million to do research in those areas for the federal government.
Mr. Chair, I might use this question to segue into my next issue that I think is important to at least spend a little time with the committee on, and that is President Kapsner mentioned the cooperative effort between ONC, I believe it is, and the department. That's another way we've been able to do things with less money, and we'll continue to try that, and that's cooperate with communities like the Aleutians East Borough, with Native organizations, ABCP, tribal organizations, federal agencies, have all put money into very often a joint project, and we'll all agree this information is needed. And I think that's been a very successful way to help us stretch our dollars and focus information gathering on those issues we need, and also bring people into the management system. So we're going to continue to work on trying to develop cooperative relationships with the federal agencies. Obviously, federal funding is 30% of our budget. It's more than our general fund. We're about 29%, 28% general fund. And so I was going to talk a little bit about the subsistence, memorandum of understanding, and cooperative agreement that
I think, Commissioner, what I'm going to do, it's a little after 3 this afternoon here, and a lot of these people have other places to go to. We got started a little late. What I'm going to recommend with my co-chair here is that she'll very likely proceed to bring you folks in on the game side and start looking at some of the access and the you know, the predator issues and things of that nature on the hunts and things of that nature. At that point in time, Mr. Vice Chair will very likely have some input and some information that he'll want to gather, as well as some of the other committee members here. So we'll, I think what we'll do on the subsistence thing, what I'd like to do is to give this co-chair an opportunity to bring you back and bring in some of the game side. And then the both of us would invite you back, and we'll take a look at some of the litigation issues like Glacier Bay and subsistence, generally speaking, and how you're interrelating both on the fish and the game side with our the new federal partners that we have to deal with. Do you feel comfortable with that, Madam Chair?
I don't have a problem with it.
Do you feel comfortable with it?
I'll
get you a pillow.
I don't feel comfortable with it, but I will make that
option. You'll get comfortable with it.
Yes, I'll bring my pillow and my pillow.
All right.
Thank you.
We're done for today, but if you would like legal issues, I think you might have meant that. If you need legal issues.
Actually, I would like the department as well as the legal to come in. Yes, when we call, we'll give you a call and we'll let you know what specifically we're looking for.
Okay.
But I'm interested in not only the legal implications of it all, because that's very important, vis-a-vis Katie John, vis-a-vis Glacier Bay, Radovich. I mean, I'm going to want some of that type of stuff. But I'm also really interested in something we had here a year ago where we said, you know, how are we going to manage these resources given this new criteria that we have?
Right.
I mean, I'm told that the department is negotiating with, and the Board of Fish, for example, Fisheries, were telling us that they have 7 or 8 entities out there that they're dealing with. And I think it's really important as policymakers that we kind of have an understanding of where we, the state, are in that whole thing here and what's our risk. And we'll do that, but we can't do it in just a matter of a moment or two, and so I don't want to deal with it at this time. Perhaps, Representative Catton, did you have another question?
No, that's okay.
Do you feel comfortable with all of this?
I'm very comfy.
You're very comfortable. All right. Madam Co-Chair.
I would like to invite Kevin Delaney back at the future meeting, too, because I did have some questions.
You feel comfortable with Kevin?
No, but I would like to have him.
You don't want him to be comfortable, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Kevin, we'll, as we have here, we'll extend the invitation back, and we'll trust your good judgment to make certain that you bring some people back. And I apologize to many of you who have come up here, and I know you have a tremendous amount of input. As I've said before, I believe that this committee and the state managers are, in essence, kind of a team. Our job is to oversight your activities. Your job is to tell us where you're having problems and what we can do to help you. And when we see things that our constituents are telling us that, you know, you're not doing right, then we have a responsibility to bring it forward to you and hold your feet to the fire on those instances as well. And that's the way we come up with good overall management principles and practices in the state. And so with that, if there's no other questions of the committee here, thanks for the full house for being here. It is now 3 o'clock. We are adjourned.